is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we take a look into America's racial divide by looking at the 1970 murder of a young black man, a 23-year-old veteran, Henry Merrow, in Oxford, North Carolina. Our guest is Timothy Tyson, a professor of African American studies who is white. Tyson was a 10-year-old Oxford boy when Merrow was killed. The murder deepened the racial gap in Oxford and changed Tyson's life. Professor Tyson has written a book about the murder and its aftermath. The title is Blood Done Signed My Name, A True Story. Timothy Tyson heard about Merrow's death from a playmate and neighbor whose father was one of those responsible for Merrow's death. In the wake of the killing, Oxford erupted. We'll talk about what happened and what the events leading to Merrow's murder and the murderer's aftermath tell us about the struggle for racial equality in America. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Timothy Tyson, is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His last book, prior to this one, Radio Free Dixie, Robert F. Williams and the Roots of Black Power, won the James Rowley Prize and was co-winner of the Frederick Jackson Turner Prize. His latest book, Blood Done Signed My Name, A True Story, is published by Crown. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Tim Tyson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on Afternoon Magazine, Celeste.
My pleasure. The title of the book comes from a gospel song that started out as a slave spiritual. Would you tell us about its history and its significance?
Well, Blood Done Signed My Name, as you said, it started out as a slave spiritual. It then becomes a kind of a blues song. Cutie Ledbetter, Leadbelly, better known as Leadbelly, sang it from his Mississippi prison cell. You know, it's a very southern song. It became a gospel song. And then after World War II, when black hopes began to rise for a kind of new country and the black veterans came home, a group of them called the Radio 4 did it, and it's really almost a rock and roll song. So I like that kind of ascendant trajectory. It also speaks to me because obviously the killing of Henry Merrow changed my life and my family's history and my hometown, and it was the blood in a certain way that did that. It's also a reference to family. This is very much a family story, and there's a kind of legacy on that in that sense that connects to. It's also while Blood Done Signed My Name is not a explicitly religious book exactly. It is a story of faith in a way, and Henry Merrow's murder is a kind of crucifixion. And so there's a reference to blood in there, too.
Yeah. You say at the close of the book, our history reveals that the blood has signed every one of our names. And looking at history with eyes and minds wide open, what does that offer us?
Well, I think it's important that we bear in mind the sacrifices that have been made so that we can all have equal citizenship. You know, this was not the Civil Rights Movement is depicted as a kind of call on America's conscience that America fundamentally answered. You can get the sense every January when we hear about Martin Luther King that somehow a black preacher made a beautiful speech and everyone said, oh my, it's wrong, and the walls came tumbling down when, of course, it was really a violent and tumultuous struggle. And only partially successful, and has left many scars that haven't been dealt with. And I guess this book is in a certain way, is my way of trying to set the record straight and allow people to have a kind of public conversation about our past and to make some kind of redemptive effort at reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. There's something else I think you say at the end of the book, though. Redemption, we have to maybe rethink our ideas about redemption in terms of it's not an instant mix. You don't just add water and presto, you have it.
Yeah, I think we still don't have an honest self-evaluation about what we went through. You can get the idea from seeing popular depictions of the movement that Martin Luther King, for example, was very popular and that most people supported the civil rights movement. It's hard to find anyone with a bad word to say about it, when in fact, you know, that wasn't true at all. Some polling data that I came across when I was doing the research for this book, for example, after Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, 63% of Americans said that this movement has gone too far and too fast, when in fact we didn't have the Civil Rights Act, so there were still white and colored signs up. America was still formally segregated, and we hadn't had the Voting Rights Act, so African Americans didn't have a clear access to the vote in many parts of the country. So, and yet people thought it had gone too far and too fast.
Yeah, I think you point out in the book something that I really had never been aware of, that the occasion of Martin Luther, his death anniversary, was cause for celebration. I mean, it was celebrated.
Yes, many places it was.
Yeah.
People, politicians who opposed everything that Martin Luther King stood for, annually push their way onto podiums and make speeches in his honor, often taking positions that he never would have espoused.
Mm.
So it's just a kind of, I think we've done what a lot of us do in our individual lives. We've done this as a nation, which is to create a kind of sugar-coated version of the past and tell ourselves a story that we can live with, but a story that doesn't bear a lot of resemblance to what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you personally to go back to this time and investigate what had happened and your family's response, the community's response, and so on?
Well, it was painful in some ways. You know, trying to come to grips with our imperfections and my own internalized white supremacy and my family, although my family was dedicated to a certain kind of Martin Luther King vision of where the South ought to go and where the country ought to go. On the whole, you know, our own blinders were very substantial. And then, it's also a story about terrible injustice and a brutal killing, and that was hard. And one of the things I think we all have to deal with sometimes is that people that we love and people that we respect and honor are nonetheless not angels and saints, and don't always do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at what happened in Oxford, North Carolina in 1970. You know, 1970 seems so close and yet so far away. I was this summer I was trying to get my driver's license. So I was present but not present, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You would give us a glimpse back to 1970 and what was going on and where we were.
Well, in Oxford, the central fact of the spring of 1970 was that finally, after 16 years after the Brown decision, Oxford was going to integrate its schools in the fall. So we were 3 months away from full-blown school integration, and many people were upset about that. That was true a lot of places in the country. Also, President Nixon had expanded the Vietnam War into Cambodia, and about 2 million people had taken to the streets in protest. A week before Henry Morrow was murdered, National Guard troops at Kent State fired into a crowd of demonstrators and killed 4 students. A week after, Mississippi State troopers fired on a women's dormitory at Jackson State University and killed two students and wounded dozens more. There was Augusta, Georgia. We had a mentally retarded teenage boy who weighed about 90 pounds, got beaten to death by the police in jail. And there were riots in Augusta where the governor ordered the Georgia State troopers to fire on the crowd with shotguns, with buckshot, and wounded dozens of people and killed half a dozen one day. You know, the Weather Underground blew up a bomb in the New York City police station, you know, that month. It was, the whole country was really in a kind of upheaval about what America meant, about what race and nation and freedom meant, and the war in Vietnam, and the role of African Americans in this society. The civil rights movement had not won any clear-cut victories, and since the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and Martin Luther King had been assassinated 2 years before. Mm-hmm. We were at the height of the Black Power movement. There was a, you know, the gap between black and white probably never higher. So it was a really turbulent time.
Yeah. And what kind of town was Oxford in May 1970? Had the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s made an impact on Oxford?
Well, you know, we historians tell the story of the civil rights movement like it's the Civil War, a series of battles. You know, Montgomery and Little Rock and Greensboro and Albany and Birmingham and Freedom Summer and so on, as this kind of, as if these things weren't happening practically everywhere. You know, the civil rights movement was happening in Illinois. It was happening in little towns all across the country. And it happened a lot of different ways in a lot of different places. Some places, nonviolence was at the core of things. Some places were practically a race war. In Oxford, Oxford's a little tobacco market town, about 8,000 people. Big tobacco warehouses in the middle of town, made of wood, filled with tobacco. Granville County, Oxford's the county seat of Granville County, which produces more tobacco than any other county in the world. In 1970, we still hadn't really gotten integration. There had been some sit-ins and some demonstrations that turned into a riot, actually, in 63. But there had been some committees that had been put together to try to sort of communicate or do something like that. But nothing had really changed. The town was still segregated. The movie theater, it became clear that the federal government wasn't going to let you use tax dollars to maintain segregated facilities, the town sold its parks, sold its swimming pool, all the public facilities, so they wouldn't have to integrate.
Yeah.
So that's how it was. And then this murder occurred, which really could have happened anywhere and could have happened most any time, really. But it happened at a time when things were very tense, and then set off this huge protest movement, inside of which was a group of black Vietnam veterans who met at the pool hall after hours and made bombs and conducted what they called a military operation. Their premise being that when they cost white people enough money, they burned the tobacco warehouses and a bunch of other buildings to white-owned business property, on the theory that essentially when they increase the cost of white supremacy, that the local white power structure would relent.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a lot like the kind of Martin Luther King Day celebrations the depictions of the movement that you see in that context. But it was not that different from what happened in a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, why was Oxford so resistant to integration, and why was the rest of the country? Oxford is, I hesitate to use the word, but a microcosm. You know, as you said, it could have happened anywhere.
Well, you know, this was a, white people had dominated public and civic life in the United States since before it existed. You know, we've all been here together for about 400 years, and from the very beginning, you know, black people came here in chains, and the role that they would play in this country has been the central issue in our domestic life in many ways. And Oxford, you know, was changing like the rest of the country, it was moving from being an agrarian economy that depended on cheap black labor to being something else. And then there was this, you know, black Southerners essentially had formed this movement that forced people to reexamine that. So, you know, it was a bitterly divided place.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the book that the 60s for Oxford were a boom time. But at the same time, while the town was welcoming people to town, it also kind of held a handout. You can come here, but you can never say you're from here.
Well, a lot, I think that's a little bit... small towns are often like that,
yeah.
Oxford more than most, I think. Was kind of a blue blood place, and people would think of you as not being from there, not realizing you'd been there 27 years or something. You know, but if your family wasn't one of the original families, that was people tended to look on you as an outsider.
Yeah, new people.
New people.
The new people.
And I think that's kind of a small town thing.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I think Oxford is kind of a microcosm.
Yeah. The late 1940s and the 50s, black veterans moved the country to a consideration of civil rights. And here we are in Oxford, North Carolina, the 60s, early 70s, another push from another generation for civil rights from veterans, this time from Vietnam. Tell us about that and how that pushed the situation in Oxford.
Well, there's kind of a long-standing tradition in American history, really, of black veterans, you know, signing up and serving for their country and then coming home and not being willing to put up with the kind of things they left. And we saw that after World War One, and we saw that after World War Two. In many ways, if you look at the shock troops of the early civil rights movement, people like Medgar Evers and Amzi Moore and Robert Williams and the people who really got things going in the late 40s and early 50s, most of them are World War II veterans. And Vietnam was a bit different. You know, the Vietnam veterans were not interested in nonviolence. They had very little faith in America. They felt they'd been lied to about this war. They had, many of them developed a kind of racial explanation of the war. They felt that they were being used to invade and dominate people of color in another part of the world on behalf of white people in America, that the war was not about democracy, that they were being used to fight for allegedly free elections in South Vietnam when they hadn't had a free election in Mississippi since Reconstruction. And so there was a real bitterness, I think unusually, more so than the World War II veterans even.
Yeah.
And, of course, Martin Luther King had been assassinated, and that was a real dividing line. If you look at what is going on in the United States Army, the experience after that is very different.
Right.
And, was an embittering kind of thing.
Yeah.
In fact, there are opinion surveys done with black veterans in Vietnam that show, you know, vast majority of them intended to come home and join the Black Panthers or something like it, didn't believe in nonviolence and intended to come home and do something about it.
Yeah.
So it was, in some ways, we were lucky to get off without worse violence than we had.
Hmm. The leaders of the revolt in Oxford, North Carolina, that you've talked with since, what do they have to say about what happened?
Well, you know, they had very little faith in the judicial system, and they felt that the judicial system was really run by white people for white people and preserved white power. And certainly the murder of Henry Marrow and the murder trial that happened that summer didn't do anything to undermine that sense.
Right.
And so they essentially wanted revenge.
Yeah.
And one of them told me, he said it was as far as the political calculation they were involved in, which in many ways is a very traditional and conservative one. He said, look, it was just like we had a cash register down there at the pool hall counting up how much money we cost these white people. We knew if we cost them enough money, they would change things, which is not visionary. You know, that's really what politics around the world is like most of the time. Mm. You know, it's an exercise in coercion and persuasion at the same time. And that was what they felt that there wouldn't be a change any other way.
You were a boy of 10. Tell us how you learned of Henry Merrow's murder from the boy next door, Gerald Teal, and tell us what had happened at his father's store.
Well, I heard about this murder on May 11th, 1970, when Gerald Teal walked up in my yard and said, and I quote, "Daddy and Roger and them shot him a nigger," unquote. And he was telling me that his father and his two older brothers had killed Henry Merrow, 23-year-old Army veteran, at their family store. They had a store out, a kind of crossroads country store in the edge of a black community on the outside of Oxford, and they had a convenience grocery and a barber shop and a gas station and a car wash, kind of little business establishment. Merrow had gone up to the store to get a drink for his aunt, and he was alleged to have said something flirtatious to Robert Teal's daughter-in-law, who was working there. And he was confronted about that by Teal's son, Larry, and then he immediately denied having said that, and he denied that he was even talking to her. But they ran for the guns. He ran as fast as he could, got about 200 feet off of their property before they shot him in the buttocks with a shotgun, knocking him down. He skidded on his face in the gravel. They came over and broke a shotgun stock over his head, fracturing his skull very badly and flipping him over onto his back. And then, as he begged for his life, they put the barrel of a rifle down on his forehead and pulled the trigger. The prosecutor said they killed him like you or I would kill a snake. Mm. So there was a riot that night. And I remember going down to the corner that evening after supper and seeing my friend Gerald's house with armed men all over the front porch, some of them wearing Ku Klux Klan robes and hoods. In the morning, we walked to school, and there were state troopers with shotguns on every corner. They had come and taken over the town with about 100 state troopers and police everywhere. We had a curfew. Stores downtown were boarded up with plywood because all the windows in town had been broken. And then after this initial riot, there was a protest movement that grew up, and they marched to Raleigh and Raleigh, the state capital, and tried to talk to the governor, and he wouldn't meet with them. And then that night when they got home, after being turned away by the governor, somebody burned up the lumber company, and the next night, two big warehouses. And so, Oxford just burned on in my memory. We ended up having to leave. And I stayed in touch with Oxford and went back there in the summers to work. And then when I was a freshman in college, I went back and interviewed Robert Teal to ask him why mm-hmm. they had killed Henry Merrow. And that's really where this book started.
Yeah. What was that interview like?
Well, it was a little unnerving, frankly.
Yeah.
Robert Teal had a reputation and a record of attacking anybody who fooled with him with whatever weapon lay at hand, and had committed just about every violent felony I'd ever heard of. He wouldn't talk to me at first, and I stayed in his barbershop for a long time, just taking note of how he spoke and the kinds of things he said, and passing the time, getting a haircut. But then my friend Gerald, who had told me about this murder initially, I hadn't seen Gerald since we were 12, really. And he drove up to the barbershop just by my good fortune. And when Mr. Teal realized that Gerald and I knew one another and that I was who I said I was, he just picked up my tape recorder and turned it on and said, and I quote, that nigger committed suicide coming in my store wanting to four-letter word my daughter-in-law, unquote. And so that was the first research I did, was to get the story of the man who'd been responsible for this murder. Hmm. Later, I went back when I went to graduate school, I went back and fell in with the black radicals who had burned much of Oxford, and they agreed to tell me their stories. And then, of course, I also did a whole bunch of historical research of the more ordinary kind, you know, FBI files and police files and court documents and newspaper and all that sort of thing. And then and wrote a very scholarly master thesis on this subject 12 years ago, but then picked it up a couple of years ago and began. I realized that I really couldn't tell this story as a kind of historian in a traditional sense, that it was too personal, and that I needed to take this thing sort of head on and write it in a voice that was more authentically my own. So that's where Blood Doesn't Sign My Name came from.
Yeah. Now, if we went to the library in Oxford, we could read a portion of your master's thesis, but not all of it.
Yes, when I finished the master's thesis, which was a kind of healing experience for me, I felt like I had come to grips with the facts, really, if not the larger truth entirely, but I had come to grips with the facts, and I delivered it to the public library in Oxford and put it there so that people in the town could do the same. But somebody went in and read it and tore out the pages where I narrate the killing. I don't know who did that, but I think we've pretty much corrected the omission with this book.
Mm-hmm. They can't.
But I think that's, in some ways, that speaks to the... There's other things that have happened in that regard. For instance, the court documents were taken out of the courthouse. I got to use them, some of them, but those disappeared. And then the local newspaper also disappeared. It disappeared from the public library and disappeared from the state archive, and the Oxford Ledger, which is the name of the newspaper, they claim not to have it either. So there was a lot of trying to cover up what had happened.
But you can't really disappear history.
No, I think we're firmly in history's grip, whether we acknowledge it or not, and sometimes more so when we don't acknowledge it. You know, but people have got this idea that you can. It's kind of like they think if you throw away the empty cake plate, you'll lose weight. You know, but in fact, of course, what happened happened, and who you are is a function of who you have been. And you know, you can go to your psychiatrist and tell her that you've always been a shining exemplar of model behavior, and that you've always stood up and done the right thing, but you're not going to get better that way. Mm. You know, we all need to have an honest confrontation with our past, both as a nation and as individuals, and that's sort of what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I really like the quote you include from Faulkner. The past is never dead. It isn't even past.
Yes. Well, we walk in the footsteps of the past. You know, it's not like you get up every morning, Celeste, and go and roll out a blueprint and say, this is how the world ought to be today. You know, you start out kind of where you were yesterday, and we're all growing and changing, but we are who we are, and that's very much a function of who we have been. And so we don't have anything to make the future out of except the past. And so if you're in denial about it, then it makes it, and I think this is really the more important point, is that it's hard to become who you want to be, and who you dream of being, and who you'd like to be, if you deny who you have been and don't know who you are.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Timothy Tyson. He's a professor of African American Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He is the author of Blood Done Sign My Name, A True Story. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can call us with questions, comments. You can join the discussion by giving us a call at either 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign who is waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hello, Professor.
Hello.
I generally call whenever people like you and Derek Bell or any other person wants to deal with race in America, because there is strangely, even on WILL, in my experience, there is deafening silence in terms of calls when this issue is broached, as opposed to other issues where I've heard one person, for example, call two or three times during the same conversation. So I'm African-American, and so this inability to discuss race in an honest, truthful way, even on a station that I applaud for raising these issues, is nonplussed to me. But my question to you, if I can think of one, I'm a veteran.
Yes.
And so I can subscribe to the notion, as I suffer the indignity du jour, being an African-American who's done quite a bit. I don't want to go into that. Sort of like Fannie Lou Hamer once said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Amen.
So I know how veterans have felt.
Yes.
When they suffered more indignities than I, after serving in harm's way, trying to prove through the shedding of their blood that they were entitled to dignity in this country. In fact, there's a book I just read, Blood for Dignity, in that regard. I was going to a Southern university, in the same state that Little Rock was, and I was one of the few African Americans there, and happened to be sitting in the student lounge when he came across the wire that Dr. King had been assassinated, and there was a tremendous applause among the white students who were sitting there with me, and I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget that moment. It's seared in my mindset, and so when I hear all of the applause about his Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day and We Shall Overcome, I basically shut that out, because in my heart, in reading his biography and autobiographies, I know that type of applause would not be issued to him if he were still alive. And so I just would rather we move on and try to deal with these issues instead of doing what I'm sure Dr. King would have disdain for, you know, mindless statements like we shall overcome when we're not overcoming. So that's all I want to say.
Well, thank you
for your.
I'm sorry, is the caller still there?
Here.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't know if you were wrapped up or not.
I'm wrapped up.
Okay.
I just wanted to.
Could I ask you where you were in school in Arkansas?
University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, where very few African Americans at that time were allowed to go. We were allowed to go, but the hostile environment made it very a very disturbing task to try to go up there as an 18-year-old African American and to put up with the daily assaults, verbally, generally, upon our integrity because we were, quote, out of place. Why didn't we go to the historically black college, a university in the state of Arkansas? So that atmosphere, I'll never forget it. And it's something I guess you should grow out of, I guess, when you become, quote, successful in America, end quote. But the indignities that were heaped upon us as 100 students out of a population of over 10,000, within the classroom, outside the classroom, within the dormitories, is something I'll never forget. And I just wish Americans could sit down and talk about our history of racism, where we should go in light of that history of racism, and deal with the problem honestly and objectively, as opposed to hiding behind these thinly disguised shibboleths like we shall overcome and Dr. King was a wonderful man and we'll judge people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. I find that to be disingenuous at best.
Well, thank you. I think that you make a real good point. My daughter came home from elementary school. Now, my daughter grew up in a house that was where civil rights activists and lots of black folks were in and out all the time, you know, aging Black Panthers and the like. And she went to second grade and came back from the Martin Luther King celebration and came to me and said, "Daddy, I thought Martin Luther King was black."
Right.
She had listened to the program and had somehow had assumed that they were talking about a white man who wanted everybody, who was just some kind of Santa Claus, who wanted everybody to be nice to everybody. Yeah. And really, you know, I think that we kind of present him as a kind of genial and vacant figure into which we can pour whatever good wishes.
But he was more radical than that. And not only was he radical in terms of being a civil rights advocate, but when he went over and began to criticize the Vietnam War,
absolutely,
that made him even more radical. So this sugarcoating of history, and I think I'm borrowing a term that you've used, this selective or collective amnesia or collective denial that white folks are in, and some black folk.
Well, it's uncomfortable, you know.
Clarence Thomas, for example.
Yes.
It's just mind-boggling to me, and it does not do us as a race, as a country, as the United We Stand against terrorism, it doesn't do us one bit of good. And that's just the way I feel. And I've served in the United States Armed Forces. I have moved to the highest levels of this University of Illinois. And yet you can still, I'm sure, detect in me an air of residual bitterness in terms of how this country woefully deals with the issue of race in America.
Well, amen.
As W.E.B. Du Bois said, in the 20th century, the problem is the color line. I'd like to add an addendum to that. Unfortunately, in the 21st century, the problem continues to be the color line. And I hope you have a great day.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Thanks for calling this afternoon. We have another listener on the line with us this afternoon from Terre Haute, Indiana, on the toll-free line, line 4. Hi.
Hi. I had a few questions for your I'm trying to move away from my radio. I've been listening and enjoying your program. I think it's wonderful when people go out and actually dig for truth and publish it. Several of my friends and I have been discussing the fact that, you know, it's kind of unusual that these things get pushed aside and pushed under rugs. And when they are brought to light by individuals such as yourself, people still try and push them aside and push them under rugs. Are you planning on trying to make any attempts to in Oxford to educate some of their youth, since the pages of the book seem to keep getting pulled away? Or are you just going to try and surround the area with this publication, or is it a statewide situation?
Well, I've been spending, you know, I wouldn't say, first I'd just say that Oxford's not really any different than most other communities. You know, if you can put your finger down on the map just about anywhere and find some kind of really horrible racial atrocity or uprising that has divided people, that people know about but don't talk about. There's often a cloud of silence around these things. I've been spending a lot of time in Oxford. Some of the white people are upset about the book. My friend, who's the father of the local Episcopal church there, says there are two kinds of white people in Oxford. They're the people who are mad about the book and the people who have read it, and that the two things don't overlap very much. That the black community has been, without whom I really couldn't have written the book, have been very supportive, and they're very happy about sort of breaking this silence around this subject. So, and there's been a remarkable amount of willingness to talk about it, and in fact, we're organizing a public discussion in September at one of the local churches and inviting the whole community to talk about this. So I've been happily surprised that people have been, more people than I expected, have been willing to talk about the book, and it's certainly flying out of the bookstore. So, you know, I've been surprised, honestly.
I want to, before we run out of time, I want to talk about your parents a bit. They were committed to racial equality, and your father, following the murder, he wanted to reach out to the community. He wanted his congregation to help the healing, but it was not to be.
Well, You know, this was the big issue that we were confronting in the years when I was growing up. And if you were, you know, my father was a white Methodist minister, a kind of Eleanor Roosevelt liberal, he called himself, in later years. But and he was a kind of local activist in a certain quiet way. He was in the habit of inviting black ministers to speak at our church, for example, and did a lot of things across the color line, tried to operate as a kind of swinging door, if you will, between the black and white community. What he was willing to do and what liberals of his generation were willing to do really wasn't adequate to the situation. We really needed a whole new social structure, and, you know, they were sort of willing to serve on a committee and talk about things, and I don't mean to disparage that. And certainly he tried to teach us right from wrong and tried to inform us in a deep kind of way about the history of the race problem and tried to teach us that Jesus died for all human beings and that we were all one human family. So I don't mean to disparage that. I don't know that it amounted to much. Nonetheless, what he did was too much for his congregation, and we ended up having to leave Oxford in the wake of the upheavals there. But, you know, he just kept on keeping on, as a friend said, and has been a very successful minister. There was no way to be uncontroversial without just being silent, and he didn't think you'd be much of a man or much of a preacher if you were silent. So it was very important to me to watch him in a difficult situation try to do the right thing, you know, at some cost to himself. But, you know, we got death threats, and there was always somebody trying to run us out of town, it seemed, when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But Oxford was the only place where we had to leave, really.
Yeah. Well, in the book you write about yourself, and I don't know, when you were writing this, I picture you flinching about your own self. You write, for example, that as a boy of six, you were infected with white supremacy. You say it was as if it was water and you were a fish. So here's the question I have for you. How was it that your father became committed to racial equality? And how did that happen in your life?
Well, in his case, he grew up in a house with my grandfather. Jack Tyson had really, as a young man, been a member of the Ku Klux Klan and a fundamentalist and pretty uneducated. But as he got older and got some education, he just changed his mind, and he became a kind of race radical in the 1940s. This is my grandfather. And he worked with black preachers teaching sharecroppers to do arithmetic and add up their own bills at the store. And, you know, black people came in his front door and sat at his dinner table. And that was unusual in those days. So my father grew up with that. Although I'm sure that, you know, I'm not trying to say that he was some kind of visionary, you know, or that he hadn't imbibed that same culture of white supremacy. But then my father went to Guilford College in Greensboro, a Quaker school, where he met people who were working for racial justice in the late 40s and early 50s, and read the works of dissident white Southerners like Lillian Smith. And when black Southerners rose up and began to organize, he responded to that. So in some ways, he was just a committed Christian who had this kind of vision of racial equality. And then when this became an inescapable public issue, he stood up on that. So that's where that came from for him. And in many ways, what I'm doing, I grew up in a different world in some ways, because the world I grew up in was more violent, and the racial, even though the formal legal barriers had been struck down, the chasm between black and white in the place where I was growing up was really in some ways deeper than the world he grew up in. It was hard to communicate across the color line in the early 1970s at the height of the Black Power movement with National Guard troops downtown and police in the hallways of the school. But I think that for me, growing up in his house, you know, I was very proud of him. And I was mad about folks mistreating him too.
Mm.
And so it was a very formative thing for me. And then in some ways, doing this research and coming, which I began when I was very young, really, doing that also, you know, I wanted to know why. And I just kept pulling at the string and sort of following it down all the way back to the Atlantic slave trade. And, you know, once I got a handle on the truth about American history, or at least some small t truth about American history, then my world made sense to me more. And I've been happy about that ever since.
Mm.
I feel very blessed.
I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It was wonderful reading your book, although there's a lot of pain in it. But thank you so much for writing the book and talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Celeste. I really appreciate you having me on. I've enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure. Timothy Tyson is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He is the author of Blood Done Sign My Name, A True Story. The book is published by Crown. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason. Todd will be joining us here in just a moment. Todd will have all the numbers from the Board of Trade, and then I'll be back with numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Here's Todd.
Thanks very much, Celeste. Good to be back in the saddle here at the radio station after a few days off, trouncing around parts of Ohio where, man, the corn just didn't really look all that good. But I was in a portion of the state that doesn't grow much corn, and it was anywhere between a couple of inches high to, I don't know, three and a half feet high, but just not like the kind of corn we have in the states of Illinois and Indiana for sure. Let's take a look actually at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade and see what they're thinking. In fact, they're trading off the weather today, and they pushed the market in the corn lower, down anywhere between 1 and 5 cents. The beans were higher in that nearby contract of the July, of course, being short of the crop this summer, but the rest of them were a bit lower. And the wheat pit, we'll start there for the day, was lower too, 339 the high for the day, the low at 332.5. A settlement price there at 334, down 7. September wheat, 347, the high, the low at 340.25. Settled 341.5, down 6.75 in December, down 5.75 for the day. 360, the high, the low at 354. Dease wheat settling at 355.25. March contract now, 370.5, the high, low at 364.5. A settlement price at 365.25, and it was down 7.5 cents on the day. May futures, 374.5, the high, the low at 369, settled at 369. Down 7 cents. July corn 248.5 high, low at 243.75, settled 244.5. They were down a nickel on the day. September futures 5.25 lower, 251.75 the high, the low at 247.5, settled at 248.5 for the September contract. December contract 4.75 lower, 256.75 the high, the low at 252.75, settled a penny above that at 253.75, down once again 4.75. The March contract 4.75 lower as well. 264.25 the high there, the low at 260.5, settlement price at 261.25. May futures in the corn pit, 269 high, low at 266.25, settlement price for May at 267, 4.5 cents lower. July, 272.5 high, low at 269.5, the July 05 contract settling at 269.5, down on the low at 5 cents lower for the day. September futures, 269.5 on the high, the low at 267, settled 267.25, they were off 3 cents. And December futures for 2005, 264 the high, the low at 263, split the difference at 263.5 on the settlement price, down a penny for the day. July oats, 136.25 high, low at 135.5, settled there as well, up a half cent. And September futures, 139.25 high, low at 135.75 the low, settled at 137. They were down a quarter of a cent for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby July contract, the only gainer in the pit for the day, 975 the high, the low at 941. Settlement price at 972.5 on those short supplies, up 11 cents. August contract on out, though, looking at the bean crop and the weather, saying, hey, it might be all right out there. 822 the high, the low at 794. Settlement price at 813. They were down 8.5 cents. September, 687.5, the high, the low at 675.75. Settled 683.75, down 1.75. In November, 660.5, the high, the low at 647. The settlement price at 653.75, down 6.75. January, 664, the high, low at 652. Settlement price at 659.5, down 3.5 cents. And the March future, 666.75, the high, the low at 654. Settled at 660.5, down 4 cents. May contract in the bean pit, 661, the high, the low at 652. Settled 655. They were a nickel lower for the day. Bean meal now, 338.50, the high, the low at 318. Settled 328.80, down 110. August contract, 2940, the high, the low at 28. August bean meal, 2883, a settlement price there, 57 lower. July bean oil, 2905, the high, low at 28.25, settled on that low, down 85. And the August contract, 28.20, the high, the low at 27.25. August bean oil settled 27.28. They finished 86 lower. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to have you back. Here's what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. It looks like feeder cattle and live cattle finished lower, while lean hogs and July bellies finished on the upside. August feeder cattle, today's high 112.10, below 110.35, the settlement 110.60, that down 50. September 111 even, 109.30, that was the high, 111 even. The low today 109.30, the settlement 109.82.5, that down 72.5. October feeder cattle 108.80, the high 106.95, the low 107.52.5, the settlement that down 80. July live cattle, 88 even the high, 88 even the low, 87.50 the settlement, and that was unchanged. I think that might be, there's something wrong there, my guess. August live cattle, 86.55 the high, 84.45 the low, 84.60 the settlement, that down 182.5. October live cattle, 88.17.5 the high, 86.30 the low, 86.55 the settlement, that down 145. July lean hog, 78.90 the high, 78.15 the low, finishing at 78.70, that up 37.5. August, 75.75 the high, 74.60 the low, 75.32.5 the settlement, that up 22.5. October lean hog, 66.20 the high, 65.10 the low, 66.12.5 the settlement, that up 40. December lean hog, 61.50 the high, 60.55 the low, 61.45 the settlement, that up 37.5. July bellies, 114.67.5 the high, 113.90 the low, the settlement 114.57.5, that finishing up 57.5. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 52 points at 10,188. The NASDAQ down 22 at 1944. The S&P 500 down 6 points at 1113.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members at agrivisor.com.
It's time once again.